We'll do it live. We'll do it live. Welcome to the Film Threat Podcast. I am Chris Gore, sometimes known as That Chris Gore, joined as always by my co-host, Anthony Ray Bench.
How's it going, everybody?
And we are live in front of the Regent Theater here in Los Angeles. We're actually at an event that the LA Alamo Drafthouse is putting on. They're doing a retrospective screening of The Matrix. We are here at the event. There's also an after party in celebration of a video game I have not played. But we're here for what?
Prey?
The free drinks. You said Prey.
That's the game called. That's what the game's called.
Yeah, but we're just here. First of all, if you have not been to the Regent Theater here in Los Angeles, it is a fantastic venue, mainly because of, I would have to say, the happy hour, wouldn't you say? Like,
they did make a really strong old-fashioned. They really did. It knocked me on my ass, to be honest.
So we're in the outdoor patio here, so if you hear a little street noise, you hear something crazy in the background, it's because we are recording this live in downtown Los Angeles. But I'm really excited this week because this is not a traditional episode of the show.
No, we finally have a guest.
What do you mean finally have a guest? We've had guests on the show. By this point, by the time this airs, we'll have had guests on the show. But this is something I've always wanted to do on the show, is kind of break out from talking about whatever movies we recently saw or movies opening in theaters, really get into a down and dirty discussion of independent film. And I want to welcome to the show Joe McClane. Everyone, big round of applause, right, for Joe McClane.
That is an amazing welcome. Thank you, everybody.
Yes. Joe, now Joe.
Drum rolls.
Drum rolls and applause.
Yeah. But Joe directed a film that I have seen that is opening actually June 9th. Is it June 9th?
VOD June 9th, Amazon and iTunes. Yeah.
Yes. So it's the digital release, right? On yeah. June 9th. So, make sure to check it out. Where this podcast is going to be running slightly before June 9th. Or maybe you're listening to this in the future. So it's June 9th, 2017.
Which means you'll have to go back in time to see the movie because it's only playing that day.
Well, that's when it opens. Yeah. But okay, so let's talk all things indie film, because you and I had one of the most amazing discussions of film before we even met. It was like this intense discussion of all things indie film. That was one of the most, because this is why I love talking to indie filmmakers, is the sort of, you're of the same mind that I am. You want to share information, right?
Yeah, so, get it done.
Yeah, and you are a no BS guy. But let's talk about, before we talk about Drama Club, available June 9th on VOD, let's talk about your previous film.
Yeah, Life Tracker.
Yeah.
Yeah, I put out a movie called Life Tracker, an indie sci-fi film in 2013. My first sort of foray, gather all your, the standard indie story, gather all your money
Life
together.
Life Tracker's science fiction. Give the premise.
Science fiction. It is a movie about a new tech company that figures out a way to look at your DNA as a timeline of your life, and therefore can predict things in your life, biological things, not like the lottery numbers on Tuesday, but like if you broke a bone when you were 8, your body like produced these things called osteoclasts and osteoblasts, which helps you mend broken bones. So if you can look at your DNA and see those chemicals in your blood at a specific point in your DNA, and then find them later on in your DNA, that could be a prediction that you're gonna break a bone in the future.
Is this based on any real science?
It's based on real science, but taking a few leaps in the future.
Right.
So it's this science about telomeres. It's the end caps of your genome. And so like when these end caps sort of unravel, these telomeres unravel, you're dead. So they can measure these telomeres, and depending on how much is left over, that means that's how much life you have left to live. Depending on how many drinks you have and how many cigarettes you smoke and whether or not you step in front of a bus. But we took it the next step and decided, we can decide when you're going to break a bone. Or if you have a certain chemical, it might mean you're going to get a certain disease. Or if you're going to whatever. So then the turning point in the movie is they find out that when everybody starts getting their death dates predicted, that most of the world's predicted to die on the same date. So there might be a cataclysmic event on its way.
I love low budget science fiction. I mean, this seems like a Black Mirror episode.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, great.
I mean, it's just, it's such
an,
it's,
to hear that.
It's no, but it's such an incredible concept. So what happened with the film? Like, you did get some traction on it.
Yeah.
So
well, listen, I mean, like, we were an indie film, you know, with a tiny little budget, but we got, we used the ability to get a couple of names involved, that minor names that helped immensely for our project. So we got Matt Dallas, the star of Kyle XY, so like already a science fiction sort of celebrity, mm-hmm, to be in our movie. We had a sports celebrity like as one of our investors, and that made other investors like, oh, well, if that person invested, I feel like my investment is sound. So they were willing to give, and then we just, you know, we got it off the ground. I, you know, one funny thing, I had a great aunt who's gone now, who was always like very interested in my career as a filmmaker in Hollywood, and knew that I was a starving artist that hadn't made it yet. And when I showed up and told, you know, the movie, yeah, the movie's out, she goes, I saw it. And why didn't you tell me? Well, what do you mean? Why didn't I tell you? Jay Thomas, the actor Jay Thomas, has a very small part in the movie. We shot out one day.
Jay
and
Thomas?
And she thought that meant I had made it. Like, in her eyes, Jay Thomas is in the movie, and that
who
meant
does,
I had
doesn't
made
he
it.
Do like, he does a radio show for Sirius XM, right?
He does
right?
do a radio
oh
show.
Oh my
yeah.
God. Wow.
So yeah,
oh, wow.
I mean, she died thinking I was a celebrity.
But
so
it's
that's
weird
good.
Because, you know, people's impressions, I mean, I'm originally from Michigan, here I live in Los Angeles, but you know that like people have an impression of what the industry is, and then there's the reality of what the industry is.
Boy, say it again.
Yeah. Exactly. But now you glossed over a couple things that I want to track back.
Let's do it.
And have you address, no, in a way, like having been the person who's gone to countless panels at film festivals,
yeah,
right, and spoken to people about how did you do this? And a lot of times people will say, so we got the money, and the things like, these are the two questions like that come up every time. And of course, we're in downtown Los Angeles, so we're gonna
it's a
hear
warning from God.
It's perfect.
Not to answer Chris's next question.
So I have to ask you, like, having been to, like, countless film festivals, and one of the things that always crosses my mind, the questions that people always ask, like, how long did it take you to make? Like, which people want to know. I don't know why they care, but, like, because you could ask, like, well, you could say, like, well, we shot it in 18 days.
Listen, I think when you're at a question and answer period for an independent film, if the audience is asking you, what camera did you shoot on, and, how long did it take you to shoot, that's a failure as far as I'm concerned, because they should be asking you about the story and the characters.
If they ask about the technical aspects, but that's the thing. What's so funny is, you know, they don't take into account. They want to know, like, we shot it in 11 days. We shot it in 18 days.
Most people don't know what that means.
But the thing is, from the time you came up with the concept to when you were screening the movie, the average time, from what I'm told, is 7 years.
Yeah.
When you talk to most filmmakers, it's like, I thought of an idea. I'm watching my movie in front of an audience 7 years.
Yeah. I have a better track record than that, and that makes me happy. Yeah.
No, in terms of time, well, with Life Tracker, how long was it?
Life Tracker, I have no idea how long the script was resonating in my head, but I finished the first draft of the script for Life Tracker in December of 2010, and we premiered it in 2013. So we got 3 years, but it was a year of
that's fast.
A solid year of that was begging and crying for money.
Well, that is the one thing that filmmakers, like, what is that book? It's Neil Gaiman's wife. Is she Amanda Palmer?
Mm-hmm.
Is it no? Is that? Am I have the name right?
That's her.
That,
yeah.
That book, The Art of Asking.
Yeah.
That book is amazing. So how do you ask someone for money for your movie?
You just have to pull your tail between your legs and say the magic words.
Could you practice on us right now? Pretend for your third film you're asking for money from us right now. Ask now for money. Just because I want to hear what that is.
I want you to rehearse.
I want the audience of this podcast to listen to this as an instruction of like how you ask for those kinds of things. It's not a simple thing. I mean...
Yes, listen.
One of the three hardest things to say is, I love you, I'm sorry, and I need help. So when you're an indie filmmaker and you're asking for help, you're asking for money, that's a specific kind of ask.
It is. It is. Listen, and I have a...
Ask me for $1 million right now.
Chris, my first movie made no money. My second movie is on track to make no money. And I need $1 million. There's no easy way to say
well,
that.
But yeah,
there really isn't. Listen, I can say that. All right, there's some facts that I can tell you. I can say that I've learned a lot. I know that, and this is just according to like the blogosphere and whatever statistics I've been able to pull off the internet, and everything on the internet is true. But I know that 80%, or I've been told and I've read that 80% of filmmakers that make a first feature film never go on to make a second feature film. And that of those that do make a second feature film,
the 20% that continued,
of that 20%, 13% of those can go on to make a second feature film. So I, 13% of 20%, I feel like I'm in a good, I'm narrowing the path down.
But that's true. Like, it's really about creating those habits, right? Like,
yes.
What is a filmmaker like? We were talking about Tim Burton earlier.
Yeah.
Right. While we were drinking. You know what?
Yes, drinking.
Let's be honest. We did a little pre-gaming. We did a little pre-gaming at the Love Song, which is the little bar that's directly next to the Regent Theater in downtown Los Angeles, where you can hear everything from the street. We probably can't hear everything from the street right now. But that is a thing, like consistency. Like, what I really feel like this is going to be an awful thing to say, but I'm just going to say this. It's more important to be consistent than it is to be good.
I agree.
For example, let's use this podcast as an example. It's not good, but it's
consistent.
Ow.
But it's consistent. It's come out every week since what, like January 2007?
More like February.
It was January, I think. I think it was
no
end of January. Okay. Is Whatever. It? We'll check the dates.
I definitely but have more get it done than get it good. I genuinely feel that way. And
that's not a bad thing to have, because at some point you're going to figure out and get it good.
Right.
Not that you haven't done that, but I'm saying, like, I'm speaking to our example of the podcast. Consistency is more important than good.
Yes,
and you
it
see
can
filmmaker,
be.
You see some filmmakers, you see actors, certain people that, like, they're always working. It's more important to always work.
True. Yeah, I agree completely.
But Life Tracker, I mean, look, the value you got from that, you were able to get a second film made.
Life Tracker was my film school. Like,
right.
I learned
but
a lot from that.
Don't you think it's cheaper, actually? Okay, you could go to grad school for film and spend $100,000.
Yeah.
More than that, going to USC or NYU, or you could just make an indie movie.
Right, listen. And I did my indie film, and it took 3 years of my life, so grad school time plus. But the budget for that movie was $150,000, okay?
Cheaper than school.
It's cheaper than school, and of that $150,000, I paid myself $4,000. So I came up $4,000 and made an indie film. I spent it all on the indie film myself. But yeah, no, it taught me way more than I think. I mean, I don't know. How can I compare? I didn't go to film school, so
I did. It was overrated. I promise you. I learned more about actually being on set and doing than I did Wayne and like sitting in a classroom. Listening to somebody who directed one episode of Hannah Montana that will never ever be shown because Disney hated it. That's who teaches film school.
I don't want to point out the obvious, but we have someone who went to film school who's doing a movie podcast, and then we have someone who didn't go to film school and who made two movies. I wonder who the winner is here.
You, sir. you win.
Listen.
Now, to be fair, though, like, I went to film school and I realized this is not what I want to do. This is not what I want to study. I want to write. Like, that's what I'm doing at Film Threat. That's what's making me happy. Being at film school, like, I was promised the experience of, you know, oh, yeah, we're going to teach you how to write, direct, produce. In the end, they just taught me how to plug things in like I was going to be a gaffer, which that's fine if people want to be a gaffer, but I didn't want to be a gaffer.
Yeah, listen, I'm on the track. Like, if I had my say in things, I would be a TV writer right now. We are definitely in the golden age, and I have not broken in yet. I've written scripts. I'm in the WGA. I've had contracts.
I guess that means you're striking.
Well, we'll see. We've got when this comes out, maybe I will be on a picket line. Yeah, yeah. I don't know. So I've got that going for me, but I have never been on a TV show, and I'm desperately trying to break in. And I... started out as an actor, and I didn't make it to Los Angeles trying to be a writer-director until I was 25 or 26. And at that point, I felt like I already needed to tackle the world as a writer-director. And now, looking back 12 years later, I feel like the opportunity I missed was the ability to go the assistant route. Like, I'm too old now at this point to, like, become a PA and work my way up to assistant and then find myself as a staff writer. I've got friends that are doing that and are on that fast track, and I'm just going, the only fucking way I'm going to... I have to win the lottery now in order to get in.
But that's still a noble way to do things. The DIY, like, a lot of people have been super successful, and a lot of people have, you know, who took the other way are still PAs. Or even
that's
worse.
That's true. But there's a hell of a lot of people that went my way that are still doing nothing.
Yeah.
So and it's funny because with all this writer strike stuff, like the people at the WGA, like, they keep preaching these facts at us, right? Like, they're telling us all the statistics. And one of the things I've heard multiple times now is that it's harder to it's harder to become a WGA member statistically than a professional sports athlete.
Wow. Yeah, I would not have thought that.
Maybe that's just because more people have the desire to, like, be rich and famous. I have no idea. But, like, that means that whichever route you take, you're fucked and you have to win the lottery in order to get in. What can you do except keep going, you know?
So what was the...
Consistency.
Yes, it's all about consistency. It's putting in your 10,000 hours. We were just talking about that 10,000 hour conversation. Like, in order to get really good at something, you have to do it for 10,000 hours.
Yeah.
Whether it's writing, whether it's, you know, working on a film, whatever it is, like, those 10,000 hours that you put in, that's your school.
I can't tell you how many people that I meet in this town that talk about the one script that they wrote that they're trying to get made that they had, that they wrote 10 years ago, and they're still, and, well, what have you done since then? Nothing. I've written dozens of scripts that have never seen outside of my own hard drive, and they might not be good, but that's part of my hours that I put in to try to learn the craft. Like, I'm dedicated for sure.
So Life Tracker, the result was that it came out and
nothing. And listen, I...
Why do you say nothing? I disagree with that statement, and nothing. It played a lot of film festivals.
No, hold on. So we did go a different route. So we got rejected from 40 film festivals with Life Tracker.
And
where we got our traction was we decided to reach out to every sci-fi convention in the country.
This is what we were just having this conversation today.
We played 20 of those.
Conventions are like the new film festivals.
Yeah.
Talk about that circuit, because the convention circuit is way more open-minded. Let's be frank for a second. There's an element in the indie film world that is incredibly elitist.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh,
and
yeah.
Your film being science fiction, right? Like, that already, like, maybe they're a little... You know, look, it's not a social issue.
It's not arty farty, like...
Right, right. It's science fiction. And really good sci-fi is all... It's a morality tale, right?
Sure.
So this, the convention route, that is another route for filmmakers.
Yeah, absolutely.
What conventions did you play? I mean, just throw a couple out, like, just what...
I mean, the very last one, the one that we closed on, was... Kamikaze, the Stan Lee Festival.
I know all the organizers.
It was just like,
event.
You know, but it was, but that's the thing is, like, so you said earlier, like, this sort of, like, the mirage of what the independent or what the film world or what Hollywood is to the people outside and what it is inside. We played in a fucking, you know, 200 square foot room on a television in a hotel, but we played Kamikaze, you know what I mean? Like, so it, that's the truth.
Kamikaze is my favorite convention.
Oh,
so,
fantastic.
Yeah.
Great.
So then after that, what led to the drama club?
The drama club, we just didn't have... There was... All right, we lost all of our money. We had all these investors. You know what?
When you say they lost it, here's why I would disagree with you.
All right.
Okay, so the people who invested in your movie... Here's what they got. They were at the country club, or they were hanging with their friends, or they were out to dinner, and you know what they said? I invested in a movie.
That's true.
Did you know that the movie I invested in played Stan Lee's comic convention? I'm serious.
You know,
so what you did is the money is meaningless to people at that level, because I know, because I've met them.
Yeah.
And they don't give a shit. What they care about is the fact that they can actually brag to their friends that they invested in a movie that had all this traction. Mm-hmm. So you think for a second you pissed away their money?
Yeah.
But you got to make a film, and then secondly, they got to brag to their friends
about making that movie.
They got to brag to their friends. Also, it's supporting the arts.
Yeah, and listen, and the big
tax write off, right?
It is a tax write off, and the big success.
This is a success.
The big success for Life Tracker was that it got a broad carriage VOD release. So before it hit like the Amazon and the iTunes,
explain what that is, broad carriage VOD release, some members of our audience.
We hit the entire country, like depending on how many, there's 100 million homes in the United States. And that is all the people that are covered by Time Warner, Cox, Xfinity, Charter, all these internet conglomerates. Those people own the cable companies, and every single one of them picked up our movie. So we were in 100 million homes if you knew our movie existed. Our movie started with L, Life Tracker. So unless you were in, new and noteworthy, or best independent films.
So you're in the middle of the alphabet.
You're in the middle of the alphabet.
So do you regret?
In the general catalog. So unless you knew we were there, you didn't find us. But the smoke and mirrors is I can tell everybody we got a broad carriage release and we were available to 100 million homes in the United States.
Can I suggest a title change for the movie?
Yeah.
A Life Tracker.
Yes. AAA Life Tracker. Yes. Yeah.
But now let's talk about Drama Club and then how that, because it sounds from what you're telling, your impression, and it's the worst thing being in this industry and being the way you and I think, because I'm very realistic.
Yeah.
I sort of know there are people that think, oh my God, I must be living the life and I live in Hollywood or the Los Angeles area.
Right.
And I'm living I'm thinking like I struggle all the time to do the things that I do.
Yeah.
To be able to do what I love and actually
just get by.
And they think it's glorious. Exactly. Yeah. They definitely romanticize being a part of.
I live in a 600-foot square foot studio apartment in Hollywood.
Would you say that mine's about the same?
Pretty much, and mine is 520. So, we're in the studio apartment club.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
high five.
Mine's a one bedroom. The one bedroom that I do have is kind of small, but I have this pretty kick-ass patio area. I got very lucky, right?
Yeah, the bat patio is amazing.
Yeah, the bat patio.
The
I've
patio.
Seen pictures. I've seen
oh,
pictures.
Cool. Yeah. The patio is not bad. I should just start having like indie film gatherings there.
Oh, I don't understand why we're not recording this in the patio.
We should have
right
recorded
now.
It there. Well, because
son of a bitch.
I thought it would be fun to meet in front of a movie theater in downtown LA.
True.
Kind of
we
fun.
Could have recorded it there and said nobody can see us here.
Right. Yeah. We could have just lied and said that we were in front of the Regent Theater.
I could have made the siren noises.
But let's get to so you're in an elite group of indie filmmakers who you're an elite group of indie filmmakers who have made a second indie film. And you're absolutely right, that sophomore movie is so important, because I have met filmmakers who've made successful indie movies, didn't make a second one. People who made unsuccessful first movies and then made a successful second one. But mostly the second one is really rough. So what was that transition from doing Life Tracker to the Drama Club?
So I knew right away that I wasn't going to
be able to...
Which
the good thing is, you've moved up in the alphabet. It's the Drama Club.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But they don't count the
the. Yeah.
They don't count the the.
Yeah. So 20% more people will see us because they'll scroll that far. I knew right away that we weren't going to have the same budget. And that sounds ridiculous. Listen, when I was trying to get $150,000 for Life Tracker, people told me every day, people have $150,000 in their couch cushions in this town. Not fucking true. Getting people to give up $20 is really hard. Anybody that's ever begged their friends and family to come out to a film festival screening of their movie to pay $10 to sit in a chair realizes how ridiculously difficult that is. And ego crushing that is.
Right.
So I knew, all right, going in, every single film book that you will ever read, and I'm assuming at film school, they tell you the way to get in.
I actually had to read Chris's book.
Ah.
Oh, the film festival book. Yeah, that's hilarious.
Chris.
Yeah,
he is a textbook. recommended reading. Recommended reading.
Oh, okay.
So what? I was recommended reading?
Recommended reading. Yeah, you were on the list.
So, any of these books that you read are going to tell you just pick up the equipment. It's cheap enough now. Go out and make your movie. Get a bunch of your talented friends together and make your movie. Don't stop waiting. Stop waiting for people to tell you it's okay to make your movie. So that's what I did. I went to a group of very talented friends. My day job is as an apartment manager, so I'm a landlord. I have a construction background. And the owner of the building that I live in has a beautiful property up. The owner of the building that I live in has a beautiful property up in Fresno, and he let us use it for free. I didn't know what the story was. I didn't know anything except I've got these friends and I've got this property. It's time to make a movie. And there's those sirens again.
We are at, you know, you're barely going to hear it on the podcast.
No, yeah. You're going to hear that.
That's a big one. There we go. So I have a location and I have talented friends, and I tell them if we're going to make another movie, we have to do what everybody says and we have to combine our resources and get this shit done. I told everybody that wanted to be involved, you have to put in a certain dollar amount. Everybody was becoming a producer, and
First of all, I think that is a brilliant idea because everyone is invested.
Yes. I had to have enough faith in them. They had to have enough faith in me to run the show. And in the end, we had a good starting number of money when we put our funds together to go out to the rest of the world and say, please give us more money.
Well, let's talk about the pitch for the drama club, right?
Yeah.
Like it's kind of I think we talked about it. It's kind of like a 90s. It's not a 90s period piece, but it's a 90s
nostalgia piece.
It's a 90s nostalgia piece, especially because what did you pay for that song that's in the movie?
Too much money.
Yeah. Talk about that, because that was a coup right there.
Yeah. We licensed The Freshman by the Verve Pipe to be in. We had delusions of grandeur to have an entire like 1990s soundtrack.
But here's what's cool. You have that song.
Yeah.
And it just roots you it roots you in that era.
That's the point, because anybody that was alive during that's our audience. We don't have our movie is a drama, a straight, talky, independent drama, which is a bad word in this town. So it's not a horror film. It's not a sci-fi. It's not something that sells easily. So we have an indie drama with no sort of like easy sellable thing. We don't have a celebrity in it. We like the first one, we don't have a famous like investor.
But it costs less than Life Tracker.
It costs less only because we were able to get less. We literally had, we did 2 years in a row because it was about a year of fundraising. At the beginning of the fundraising, the end of the fundraising, we did an Oscar pool, like pay us $20 and half of the money will go to the Oscar person who guesses the right, the most right answers, and the rest goes to our movie. We did that twice.
Oh, wow. That seems like a great idea.
We did a party at the W Hotel in Hollywood because one of our producers is a waiter there. Like, we did everything. We got alcohol sponsors to say, like, it's funny. We got half of our alcohol sponsors said, you can have our product and use it at your, like, parties and promotional events and use them in the movie. And half of them said, you cannot afford to use us in the movie, but you can have our product and put our logo in your advertising. So we were able to offer free booze and tell people to pay us for it. Whatever.
Free booze is, don't discount
free booze for money.
Is.
Free booze for money.
Yeah.
So we ended up getting, and I did have a slew of people that I had asked money for Life Tracker. And listen,
how receptive were they on the second round?
Not receptive because
you know, look, it didn't make money,
right? It did not make money.
But that's not. But investing in a movie, I don't think is about making money.
It's true.
It literally, I believe, is about FOMO with other rich people.
If
it's about I invested in a movie.
Agreed. If I had
It's like I bet on the races. I lost, but I bet on the races. Right. I'm at the horse track.
And if I had not asked any of those people for money, I would not have gotten some of the money I did get. One of the investors that invested pretty heavily in the drama club is involved in politics in Washington, D.C. And he...
Is his name Donald Trump?
Donald Trump invested in...
Donald J. Trump.
Yeah.
Invested
and,
in...
And I thought, when I was going for money for the drama club, I thought, if a politician was running and lost the election, the first thing he would do when he re-ran for election the next term is ask all the people who gave him money the first time, even though he lost all their money by losing.
Or think about it. Like, let's say a political campaign is like an indie movie.
Yeah.
And someone gave you $1 billion.
A billion.
And you ran for president and you lost your bid for president. You lost $1 billion. I don't think that's as bad as an indie movie that cost a couple hundred grand.
Are you telling me that Hillary Clinton's making an indie film?
In a way, she made an indie movie. First of all, I'm reading this book called Shattered, which is about the doomed campaign of Hillary Clinton.
Oh, boy.
And oh, my God, it's riveting. It's riveting. The inside stories of that, the chaos inside and the drama.
The only thing
insane.
We get out of this experience is movies and stories and books and art for decades and decades.
Yes, we're going to get a lot of great art as the opposition. So, but back to this. So I mean, the budget was lower. Do you care to talk about
budget?
Because I know I will often give the advice you shouldn't. But I think let's think about this. People that are listening to this podcast, they want to know about filmmaking.
Yeah.
And they want to know the realities.
Yes.
And this is the other thing I want to commend you on. You talked about like I have a day job. I'm doing Film Threat, and I have a day job because guarantee the money that's generated by Film Threat, zero, does not pay for like just for me to be able
to
live.
It's not sexy to talk about your day job.
It's not sexy to talk about the day job. But like, yeah, so I have a day job. And I love that you mentioned that because some filmmakers will go off and they have this like dream that they're going to make it and sell it for $1 million. That dream is bullshit.
Yeah, no, it's total bullshit. I have a day job, and I do disagree with the advice you say that you normally give, which is to not talk about your budget.
Well, disagree away, and let's talk about the budget.
So you are getting the scoop here, but I think that withholding information is hurting independent film. The Netflixes of the world, they are actively keeping secret how many times a product is streamed on their website, because having that information would help people understand how to negotiate against them.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? Like,
yes.
If I knew that my film Life Tracker was I can tell you this. I can tell you that when Life Tracker was released on Amazon, it was purchased on not Amazon Prime, but Amazon. It was purchased a couple hundred times, and I was making over $1 per rent on that.
You are a hundredaire.
I'm a hundredaire. When it moved to Amazon Prime, we've gotten most of our views of Life Tracker on Amazon Prime. It's 5,000 plus views on Amazon Prime. I get less than 4 cents per viewing on Amazon Prime.
Wow.
But services like Netflix, they don't tell you. You don't know how much your product has streamed. You don't know what they're offering to certain. In fact, it's in contracts. It's even been in my contracts that I am not allowed to say out loud what somebody has paid for a product, because they don't want the next person to be able to use that in negotiation.
Yep.
One thing Anthony and I can tell you is no one is listening to this podcast.
Which means I can tell you everything.
Pretty sure you can just give us the information.
Yeah. So listen, I genuinely think that independent filmmakers should divulge as much information as possible.
I agree, so they can share it and help each other out. Like, I think that's important.
Most of the people in my position are not making any money. If you know anybody that made an independent film that turned a dollar, they won the lottery. That's not a joke. That is a fact. If you know an independent filmmaker that made a movie without A-list talent or one of the mini majors behind them, they won the fucking national Powerball. That's the truth. The Drama Club cost under $70,000 to make. One of the things you mentioned earlier, the, sort of this great conversation we had on the phone, and you said something to me in that conversation that I keep thinking about, which is the Drama Club is too, I hate to say this out loud, but the Drama Club is too good to be independent, to be an independent film, and it is too low budget to be a mainstream film.
I run into so many movies like this that fit in that category that are like, that, you know, it's a sort of at a high level, like it's too good for indie, not good enough for mainstream.
I'd like to add to that and say that maybe the idea is, or maybe the answer to that question is, people that are actively seeking out independent content are not looking for mainstream ideas. My movie is very much like...
Well, I don't know that your movie is completely mainstream. I'm thinking of a particular scene in the movie.
Yeah.
I don't think we can... Can we talk about this one scene?
Yeah, we can
no?
talk about it. Absolutely.
A little bit?
Yeah. Let's
like, because the story
I'll
is...
I'll shut up if we get into bad territory.
Yeah, exactly. But like, it. I mean, like, the film is... like a reunion. It's
yes.
a kind of, I mean, it's
it's you a 20-year high school reunion.
It's a 20-year high school reunion, but you compared it to a movie that
it's The Big Chill. It's the big chill for my generation.
It's Big Chill adjacent.
Yes.
I wouldn't say it's the Big Chill.
Yeah.
But it's
You
it's
don't think I should compare myself to Lawrence Kasdan?
No, I think you No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying you're not stealing it is what I'm saying.
Yeah, okay.
Cuz
gotcha.
I didn't think that you were, you know, lifting that
right.
that concept.
But every independent filmmaker has come to a point in their career where they're like, the only way I can make a movie is to take 7 actors and put them in one location because that's all I can afford. I can't afford special effects. I can't afford multiple locations. I can't afford, you know, big names. All I've got is this, and this is what I got
to work
with.
But the movie starts at like a good clip, and you're meeting these characters, and you're learning what the dynamics of the relationships are.
Sure.
You're learning like what's going to happen with some of them, with some of the relationships where there's
right.
tension. And there's a moment in the middle of the movie where it just shifts.
Yeah.
Completely.
Shit hits the fan. Yeah.
Shit, it's the fan. Exactly. So this is why I'm also recommending this film, and why I'm ecstatic that you're on the show, and we're doing this podcast so close to the opening of the movie on June 9th, available on all VOD formats.
Yeah.
On June all VOD formats.
Well,
we
have iTunes and Amazon on June 9th, and then it will go wider after that.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, after June 9th,
it's available.
It's available. So, but there's this moment that happens in the middle of the movie that is. I was shocked because I've never seen what I consider a mainstream. I'm not saying your movie's mainstream.
Right, I get
I'm
it.
Saying a movie that isn't in the realm of mainstream, that isn't porn, that has a moment that is so
yeah. There is a
shocking
compromising
and it's,
sex scene in our movie.
So
let's just stay there. Let's say a compromising sex.
Okay,
scene.
Okay, a compromise.
Here's
there
what
is an like. Can we just say a threesome?
Yeah, we could say threesome.
It's a threesome,
yeah.
But it is a type of threesome. That I don't think has ever been seen in a movie.
Well, I don't know if I
don't,
can.
Don't
say that.
I'm just saying, I'm
yeah.
telling you that. Like
yeah.
I've never seen a threesome like that in a film. And there's certain sex acts that are performed, and it's it's not graphic in terms of the sex part.
Yeah, like,
I think
have
it's tastefully done.
It's funny that you're saying that we have a graphic sex scene.
It's not.
But there's not really. There's no nudity
there's not,
in
no,
my movie.
It's just like
there's
just,
a there's a like a shot of one man's ass
it's,
in
it's
my
just,
movie.
Right, it's just like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. People think that movie's really gory, but when you actually, it's the sound is the thing that.
Yeah, Psycho
that,
is the same way. It's just
right.
a fucking shadow of a knife. That's it.
Right. You don't see a lot, and that's with your film, in this particular scene we're talking about in Drama Club. I guess it's graphic in the sense that like we know what they're doing.
Oh, you know what's up.
And then there's conversation about it after.
That's
and that is the
important.
Part where it's like that's where the movie really got adult and real.
So I definitely think that the movie sort of has its climax at the sex. But what makes
right.
it what makes it important though is the conversation that happens afterwards.
The conversation that happens, like the repercussions of the characters involved in that threesome,
right. and one of the
and,
things
and
that
how they it's and it's an adult conversation.
Yes,
like I've never seen in a movie anywhere.
And there's an idea that I wanted to explore a little bit, which is the idea that if I had a threesome, I could show up with my guys and smack five and be like, yeah, bro, like I had a threesome, and they think I'm the coolest guy in the room. But if a woman has a threesome, they're considered a flat-out slut. That's right. Just the way our society is. And there is an element of that in the movie where we get to see the other, we get to see the
and
other
you
side.
See you see all the insecurities of the characters involved in that. I'm speaking mostly about the male characters,
the men. Yeah.
that are insecure, and it's so well played. I have never seen anything like that in a movie.
Yeah.
And so that's where it's like that's where you got me. Like, yeah. I think our initial conversation.
It took me 45 minutes to get you.
Well, no,
I'm
but
glad
like.
You stuck you in that
whatever.
Long.
Like, you know, that was like the thing. It's like, okay, this is good. Pretty good production value. This is good. I like the characters. And then, whoa, like, it's that moment.
Yeah, there's
like,
a turn.
There's a turn. And then the shit hits the fan on multiple levels from the. Not just that, but
yeah.
Other areas of drama between those characters.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah. I don't know what you want me to say about that. Yeah,
no, I'm
true.
Just saying.
It's
just,
true. Yeah,
no, I'm just telling you that, like, I see a lot. Look, I see a lot of movies.
I think we both do, Chris.
we both see a lot of movies, and then there are those movies where you go like, "Well, that person took a risk."
Right.
So I'm just commending you on taking
that
risk.
I hope that people watch it when it's released. Maybe it's released when you're listening to this.
Have you gotten any other reviews?
I've gotten reviews. Well, all right. We got trashed by the LA Times.
Why?
They fucking hated us.
Well, but
it's the truth. I mean, I don't know. I can't tell you except what happened. They trashed us. But the only other feedback I've gotten is from friends and family, and those people can't be trusted.
No, you can't trust your friends and family ever.
Oh, they want me to succeed, so they think everything I've done is golden. It's stupid. So, yeah, no. Here's what's valuable to me. And I still do this with Life Tracker, right? Like, I enjoy watching the, like, user comments and reviews on Life Tracker on Amazon show up. And they are split pretty fucking even. Like, it's ones and fives. And what's special about it is that it's people that have never met me. They don't know anything about me. They don't know my story. All they know is that they clicked on this movie on Amazon Prime and they watched a story. And most of the bad reviews for Life Tracker are people that, and it's right there in the Amazon reviews. I turned this off after 10 minutes. All right, well, fuck you for giving me a one after watching 10 minutes.
Yeah, that's enough.
So. But there's a lot of the other half are like, I'm so thankful there's an indie film that is like this, or people saying when I see a non-rated movie, a not rated movie on Amazon Prime, I question it immediately. But I gave this one a chance, and thank God.
Okay, so what are the lessons that you learn in like doing? I mean, in doing Life Tracker, you learn lessons. You bring
sure.
those into Drama Club.
Yeah, for sure.
Drama Club, you learn lessons.
Yeah.
What lessons are you bringing from Drama Club into the next project? Because here's the frickin' thing. You have to make another movie.
I will make another movie. Absolutely.
I mean, I say if you have to make a movie with your frickin' iPhone, with
yeah.
the... Well, I mean, the
I'm
new iPhone has like a 4K.
Yeah.
Yeah, tangerine the shit out of your next movie.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the way it's going to work. In Life Tracker, I did this weird thing where it was... it is told... The story, all right, so first of all, the first mistake I made was that it's a found footage film, and I did that about a year too late. Found footage movies, people are already against them by the time I made this movie. And
I still like found footage movies. I mean, it's like, they're good ones, and they're not so good ones.
Right.
I mean,
so something that I was, like, anal retentive about was the documentary filmmaker, the character who was a documentary filmmaker making this movie, he only had access to certain equipment. So I demanded that certain scenes of the film early in the story were only shot 4:3, low def.
But I like that you create your own rules.
Agreed.
And then you follow
However,
your rules.
The lesson that I learned was that I should have shot the entire thing high def and done all of that shit in post. I should have cut it to 4:3 and degraded the image rather than being stuck with the shitty shit I captured on the bad cameras. Something that I did do on Life Tracker that I didn't do on the Drama Club that I will never do again is not to have somebody of note involved. And it's ridiculous. And I'm sorry, but when we did Life Tracker, we had press when we were announced that we were making the movie before we shot anything. We had MSN and ComingSoon.net show up to our set. We had everybody in the world review us when we were done, all because Matt Dallas was starring in this movie. They won't touch the drama club. We have submitted to all the same people. We have begged and pleaded.
Well, so that's the lesson, right? You gotta get that cast.
It's not
weird. I have a friend of mine who's an indie filmmaker, and he says the way he does it now is he gets big people in his movies. It's because he doesn't audition them.
Oh, no, you never.
What he does, you don't audition. What he does is he looks for the person who's like fifth build in Thor Ragnarok. Right. And then what he does is he just makes an offer to that person. So you're taking someone who is already a known quantity. You know that they're going to be recognizable in that from that particular property, a Marvel movie, a Star Wars movie. But he just says, here's the offer. Here are the days you're working. And, you know, sometimes they'll even bypass the manager, right?
Right.
If you have some way to contact that person, just like, hey, you want to do a movie? 5 days. This here's the money. Go.
And listen, with Matt Dallas, our casting director found him. But what the casting director doesn't really... He called me up and he was like, hey, I got this great guy. He's going to be wonderful in this role. And he told me the name. And I was like, motherfucker. I know Matt because we went to the same high school. So Matt was a freshman in high school the year I was a freshman in college. So we knew a lot of the same people. But once that fact was known, he couldn't say no to us out of like guilt and loyalty. So we got him.
So your advice is go to high school with actors?
Go to high school with actors, which is probably the best argument for film school, right? Like, at film school, you're meeting a bunch of people that are going to do this job forever.
No, but film school, but also, like, when the social networking that you do, and I'm not talking about internet, I'm not talking about Twitter and Facebook, I'm talking about the social networking that you do when you're physically at a festival.
Sure.
When you are breaking bread, when you are sharing Stella Artois, Stella, let's be honest, Stella is a huge sponsor of a lot of film festivals. So when you're drinking beers, I feel like I made the best connections at film festivals when I went to not Sundance, not South by Southwest, but at smaller, more intimate film festivals like the Phoenix Film Festival, right?
Dude,
like,
I met my AD on the drama club at the Phoenix Film Festival.
Yes.
And we both had short films there.
Right.
My producer and one of my actors was at Dances with Films. He was the director of a short film the year I had How to Make a David Lynch film there.
If you can hang and you can have fun having drinks, you can have fun on a film set.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's so fucking important. The people it's funny. When I was in high school, I used to think, okay, I should talk about this. In high school, I was this hoity-toity person. In college, I was like, Keanu Reeves is the worst actor that has ever lived.
But we love Keanu Reeves now.
Fucking love Keanu Reeves.
I will fight you, sir.
Yes. Yes. Here we are at the Matrix.
One of my you've seen that footage of him on the BART, right? Where he's just like gives up his seat. Like,
and listen.
Like he is also, I met him only once. Richard Linklater made Waking Life.
Yes.
It was at a junket. I met him and Linklater told Keanu about Film Threat and how Film Threat, what Film Threat was, and because Linklater is like a fan from way back, but like it was just cool. Like this guy's not about ego. He's not about ego. He doesn't care. He's about the work. And I love Keanu Reeves.
A lot. Here we are.
Here there's a screening of The Matrix like right now at the Regent Theater.
Which is
we're
a
talking
good reason
about
to bring him up, but I'm casting a movie where I know that we are going to be living in squalor. It's a nice lake house, but we're all going to be sleeping on the floor together, 25 people of us making this movie.
But
when I was casting and looking for the crew, I was not thinking like, who's the best filmmaker? Who makes the prettiest shot? Who's the most talented actor? It was, I need to spend 14 days living on top of this person, and if they are miserable, I'm going to hate myself. And I refuse to hate myself. So that's important.
No, super important. I mean, seriously, like, can you hang creatively with people under duress in horrible circumstances and it's still fun to... I would say to you that a lot of actors' success have to do with the fact that they're just fun to hang out with.
They can do it.
They can do it. I'm not going to hate
myself if I spend 12 hours a day on set with you in the blazing sun under shitty circumstances.
You're kind of fun to hang out with, man. So, all right. Joe McClane, you've said it all. This is fantastic.
Thank you.
This is, everyone needs to...
Thank you so much for being on our show.
No, thank you for being on the Film Threat podcast. Like, I feel like your honesty, like, is so refreshing and needed.
That's
like,
nice to hear, but this is a big deal for me because I have been a Film Threat fan since the late 90s.
Oh, stop.
Yeah.
Stop. Wait, continue.
He's begging me. He's begging me to give more. Yeah.
No, but no, look, I appreciate it. But also, like, look, we were talking about this earlier. Like, do we cover Marvel movies or Star Wars movies?
Well.
And yes, we kind of do. But I mean, to an extent, because they're out there in the zeitgeist. But we have to. At the same, having said that, like for me, if someone who listens to this because they like us talking about Star Wars or Marvel, and they learn about the Drama Club, and they learn about Life Tracker, like that to me is like that's why you know Sundance. And I will defend Sundance. Sundance will play some of these big films, right, with a lot of major celebrities.
And they will draw the press.
Right. They draw the press, and that gives attention to other smaller indie movies that need attention.
Agreed.
So that's important. So
it's a good service.
Joe, thanks for being on the show. Where can people find information about the Drama Club on social media?
You can go to gingerbeardfilms.com. Or just search The Drama Club. But it will be out. And I'm sorry, my Twitter, Joe_McLean. You can find everything there. And then also Drama Club movie. What the hell? The Drama
we'll
Club.
We'll tag you.
Yeah, you'll tag me.
Don't worry. We'll tag you.
The movie has a Twitter too. But people, yeah, it's more mine. You'll find out where the movie's at. But June 9th, watch The Drama Club. Help an independent filmmaker. Make his next movie.
No, I mean, I'm just going to echo what you say. And just like, I think it's important for people to have a balanced diet. Sure, watch your Marvel and Star Wars movies, but you have to watch indie film. This is how, and if you look at like also the people who have been hired to make the Marvel movies and the Star Wars movies, they all came from indie film.
Dude, I am
they
all came to see from Rian Johnson's incarnation of Star Wars.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Here's a guy that made Rick and Looper. Right. Jesus Christ, I can't wait to see
that. So this guy's going to make a weird Star Wars movie.
I keep hearing it's weird.
I think it's going to be weird.
Right.
And I can't wait. All right, Joe, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. This is awesome. From Anthony and I.
Let's get out of here.
I was going to say let's get out of here.
Well, let's get out of here.
Let's get out of here.
Let's get out of here.